All right. Good evening, everyone. We're here for Economic Lessons for 2020, a talk with Dr. Michael Hudson, economist, scholar, and president of the Institute of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends, and author of numerous books and publications, including Beyond the Bubble, Killing the Host, J is for Junk Economics, and Forgive Them Their Debts. I would encourage you all to go to michaelhudson.com to check out more of Dr. Hudson's work. And my name is Shali Gupta Barnes. I'm with the Cairo Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice at Union Theological Seminary. And I think, Dr. Hudson, this is our third conversation with you in the Cairo Center. And in many ways, we're returning to our roots. I first came across your work in 2006, 2007, when you wrote an article in Harper's Magazine predicting the 2008 crisis. The article was called "The New Road to Serfdom." And you wrote, "Most everyone involved in the real estate bubble so far has made at least a few dollars, but that is about to change." Now, this is before the economic crisis, before the Great Recession. "The bubble will burst, and when it does, the people who thought they would be living the way of life of a landlord will soon find out that what they really signed up for is the hard servitude of debt serfdom." Again, this was before the Great Recession, and the article just kind of laid out very clearly what was going to happen and why. And you went on to describe exactly what we saw unfold in 2008 and 2009, and 10 years later, more than 10 years later, the effects of that crisis are still reverberating out through the U.S. economy and throughout the world, even though there's talk of recovery. I don't know if you all saw the headline from the New York Times yesterday, breaking news that the economy is doing fine and the Fed is not going to change interest rates. So just going back to that article, Dr. Hudson, this isn't magic. What you were talking about in 2007, it's economics. But I wanted to start by asking you, why is it that most economists were surprised by the Great Recession, the financial crisis of 2008?
Well, let's talk about the people who were not surprised. Wall Street was not surprised. Bankers were not surprised. And if any of you were reading newspapers in 2007, 2008, or listening to TV, you wouldn't have been surprised, because already new words were being added to the English language. One word was junk mortgage. That hadn't been used before. All of a sudden, it was common usage even in the New York Times, certainly the Wall Street Journal. Another word was ninja. No income, no jobs, no assets. So 99% of the people were not really surprised at all if they followed all this. It was the FBI was not surprised, because already in 2004 it warned that the largest wave of financial fraud in American history was underway, which is why President Bush immediately removed them from the Financial Task Force and put them on the Anti-Terrorist Task Force. Only one group of people were surprised. I know that we're all in favor of disadvantaged people, and there are many people who are autistic and can't really relate to other people, and they need a job. There's a profession for them, economics. So the economists were surprised, and the other people who weren't surprised were the bank lobbyists, but they pretended to be surprised. Alan Greenspan said he was surprised because he believed they lied to people, because it would be bad. Actually, it was wonderful for the business. The banks that were the most crooked, Citibank, Wells Fargo, Countrywide, the others, they've grown tremendously. They were bailed out. They were subsidized. They were rewarded. So the banks that Greenspan imagined would lose for their lying violated the most basic economic principle that every economics should begin with. And the French knew this in the 19th century with Proudhon. Property is theft. Crime pays. Just about, I'm sure all of you know it, many of you may have been victims of crimes at least, but that doesn't play a role in the economics textbooks. The economics textbooks say, what if everybody behaves in a way that really helps the economy so much that you really need the banks and the rich people and the financiers to tell the economy where to go. So obviously they were not going to come out and say, well, wait a minute, they're creating the problem. It's all, most of the textbooks and most of the economic patter talk is a cover story for how the economy really, really works. Greenspan was told by other members of the Federal Reserve Board, there's a lot of mortgage fraud. He rejected it. He wrote an article, one of the few articles he actually wrote while ahead of the Federal Reserve, saying that there cannot be a real estate crisis because real estate's basically local in nature. Well, actually, all the mortgage lending was being highly centralized in the five big banks that I've mentioned before. Now, the other group that was, of course, the bank lobbyists that managed to get their lobbyists in charge of the government. Many people say make a sort of wrong criticism of the Federal Reserve. They say, well, the Federal Reserve is owned by the commercial banks. That's not the problem. That's not the ownership because the banks don't really have a job. The problem's not that the bondholders and the banks can own the Federal Reserve. It's that they own the government, and the government appoints the head of the Federal Reserve. The donor class gave Obama, President Obama, when he was elected, a list of cabinet members. He submitted them to Citibank for its approval, because Robert Rubin, the Treasury Secretary under President Clinton, was one of his big supporters, and he submitted it to Rubin and Tim Geithner, who made sure that they put the protectors of the fraudsters in charge of the banking system. This didn't appear in the textbooks, but as I said, everybody in Wall Street knew about it. I think, the only person who actually printed a model, economic model of it. So when the Financial Times listed the eight people who went on record saying it's all going to crash in a year, they presented a copy of the model that I'd it's reproduced in my The Bubble and Beyond and Killing the Host. So what was not acknowledged and what economists were blind to, and they're still blind to, is that fraud was great for the banks. That was their business plan. And my colleague at the University of Missouri at Kansas City, Bill Black, has done a lot of work on the criminalization of criminogenic banking. And if you go on the UMKC website or under Bill Black, you'll see all of his expose. He was the prosecutor of the savings and loan crisis in the 1980s. Most economists, if they did see it, they want to keep their jobs. And if you want to keep your job, you have to work either in academia, where you have to toe the neoliberal line and say, we need the rich people, finance is guiding the economy, or they work for companies. And they're not going to, if they do criticize the financial sector, they find that they're unable to get tenure. That's been a lot of problems with our graduates at Kansas City. So I guess for common sense, everybody knew that there was fraud. Some people thought they could get out in a hurry, but a business cycle isn't really a cycle. It takes a long time to build up, but it goes down very quick, and people were not able to get out in a hurry, as you saw, and they had to rely on the incoming Obama administration to make them very, very rich instead of losing.
Yeah, thank you for you know, kind of explaining why, you know, that first of all, those who should have known about this did, and those who didn't know were kind of willfully kind of ignoring this reality. Could you actually take us a step back? Many of the trends that led to 2000, to the Great Recession, had been maturing over a number of years. Could you just take a few minutes to help explain what precipitated that crisis? What, you know, just explain the crisis for us, and, you know, especially so we can set up the conversation about where we are today, more than 10 years later.
Well, the crisis obviously was of a financial character, and that's the problem. Finance and debt and savings don't really appear in the textbooks. Most people think of the economy as production and consumption, and you think workers go and they produce goods for sale, and other people buy them. And that's sort of the real economy, what GNP is supposed to be all about. But there's another economy. This production and consumption economy is wrapped in a financial sector. You can think of it as a great parasite wrapped around the economy. And the financial sector's product is debt. And basically, more money has been made since 1980 in buying stocks and bonds or real estate or assets or art than actually producing new things. And that's the problem we have now. What made 2008 different and what makes the current depression different is that in the past, when there was a crash, banks would lose money, as Lehman Brothers did, and they'd go broke, and they'd wipe out some people's savings would be wiped out by the fact that people couldn't pay. And what do you do if somebody owes you money and they can't pay? Well, usually you lose it. And even if you foreclose, if you've written a junk mortgage pretending that a property is worth a lot of much more than it is, then you're still going to lose money. But this crash didn't happen in 2008. There was a temporary crash, but then investors realized that the bad loans were all kept on the books. The Federal Reserve went to the banks and said, "We know you've made bad loans. We know that Sheila Bair wrote that Citibank was insolvent. Its entire capital was wiped out. She wanted to take it over and make it a public bank." But Geithner said, "None of you bankers are going to lose the money. Don't worry. We'll make you rich. We'll make the homeowners pay. You can go and continue to demand payment of your debts and foreclose, and all the money you can take all of your assets that are bad, and you can borrow from the Federal Reserve." And the Federal Reserve has created $4.6 trillion worth of credit for the banks. Quantitative easing, they call it. This money could have been spent into the economy to make it grow. It wasn't. It could have been used to pay the bad debts and leave the 10 million American families that were foreclosed on in their homes. That wasn't done. It was all given to the banks, who were responsible for the crisis, for writing the bad loans, and were not given to the bank's customers. So they were the victims of these fraudulent mortgage loans. So if you're looking at what the government policy is, since 2008, the aim of government intervention has been to save the 1%, the 10% maybe, from losing money on their stocks and bonds. The wealthiest 10% of America own between 75 and 80% of all the stocks and bonds. So when President Trump or others talk about, look how good the economy is doing, the stock market's going up, the economy means the 10%. For the Federal Reserve, the economy is the 10%. For the government and the lobbyists, the economy is the 10%. The 90% are not part of the economy. That's sort of collateral damage. So if you have the government basically trying to make sure that the stockholders and bondholders and real estate investors don't lose money, then you have the explanation for what's happening now. For President Obama and the staff he had, we've been in a depression since 2008. The depression isn't a problem for them. The depression's a solution. The depression is part of the class war. The depression is monopolizing all of the growth in GDP, all the growth in wealth in the economy and stocks, bonds, and real estate, just for the 10% that are basically the donor class. And if you think of the government and the policy as how can they serve this 10%, then you have a key as to what's happening. For instance, if you look at people talk about the GDP going up, but All of the growth in GDP since 2008 has accrued to only 5% of the population. One of our colleagues at the Levy Institute, Pavlina Chernova, has made a chart about that. For 95% of the economy, the GDP is less. For 95% of Americans, they have less disposable income after paying their monthly nut of debt service, rent or housing costs, medical insurance, other debt. They have electric bills. They have less to spend on goods and services. Well, that's why there's such a problem now. That's why a few blocks from here in Times Square, 2 days ago, you had one of the big buildings foreclosed upon because there's so many empty stores in it. I'm sure if you walk down Fifth Avenue or Madison Avenue, maybe Broadway or 8th Street, you're going to see all of the boarded up stores. That's because people are not buying things. They can't afford, they don't have enough money left to buy enough to keep employment going. And what they do buy is mainly made in Asia, China, and other countries because the corporations have sort of decided to join a race to the bottom. Let's move our production where labor is cheapest and government costs are, the cost of housing is cheapest, and they've gone to Asia. So you're having internationally a race to the bottom that's sort of leaving the United States as odd man out, and that's why there really cannot be any industrial recovery in this this country. We're not in a business cycle. We're not in a cycle that's going to recover. There is no factor here that is going to fuel an economic recovery here. Things are going to continue more or less in the way they've been in Greece or in Latvia or in other countries that are submitted to austerity. In this case, the austerity is produced by the banks and by the government policy.
And so, I mean, my fear is that 10 years later, we really haven't learned very much from that crisis and the situation that it's put us in. As you said, we're in this race to the bottom. We're seeing, you know, negative interest rates, just really curious things happening, low unemployment rates, but the costs of living are, you know, by far outpacing our incomes, record wealth inequality, as you've been saying, and even more debt. Recently saw that credit card delinquency is up higher than it's been in the past 10 years. So are we actually in a worse situation than what led to the Great Recession?
Well, 10% of the population is in a great situation. In the crash, the stock market was about 8,500. Now it's 8,500. Now it's about 28,000. The upper 10% have tripled their wealth. For all the rest of the country, it's much worse because not only is their take-home pay less, but the debt overhead has grown very sharply, leaving less and less for them, to spend on the things that you need to live on. So financial wealth has grown thanks to the Fed's quantitative easing. But one result is that of the low rates is that while it's made a lot of, it's fueled a huge stock market and bond market boom, it's left many pension funds broke because pension funds invest in bonds, basically, and they're not able. They're falling way behind in the money. Whether you're a city like Chicago or a state like Illinois or a corporation, the corporate and public pension funds are way behind. So people are not going to be able to get their pensions. You have the Democrats leading the fight in Congress to get rid of Social Security and medical care. The intention of the Democrats is to cut your Social Security roughly in half so that you can afford the Trump tax cuts, basically, and so you can afford the military buildup. If you balance the budget and increase the military buildup while you cut taxes, then you have to slash Social Security and drastically increase the medical costs and anything and the wage withholding that you have. So the strategy of the government is to very sharply increase your cost of living while reducing your income. The cost of medical care is going up. The cost of education, as you know, is going way up. And Betsy DeVos yesterday resisted any kind of rollback of student loans. So basically, costs are going up, incomes are going down. And since this is a poverty center, this is ought to be a boom for you.
Right. That's right. We're seeing our numbers growing as well in terms of the Poor People's Campaign and, you know, and the work we're doing across the country. I wanted to turn at and spend some time on this question of debt and crisis. This is something that you've written and studied about, not just in our current economic era, but from antiquity to today. And if anyone hasn't read and forgiven them for debt and forgive them their debts, I really encourage you to get the long sense of the history that we've lost actually in our economic in our disciplines of economics and our understanding of Jubilee and what that did, you know, has done over human history. But you know, there is some kind of curious agreement between mainstream economists and orthodox Marxist economists today that household debt really doesn't matter in terms of crisis formation. On the one hand, mainstream economists just see a debt to one person as a credit to another, right? And so because they can't see class, it's all a wash. And so who's in debt and who owns that debt doesn't matter. Orthodox Marxist economists like Michael Roberts and others argue that the idea of debt servicing crowds out effective demand. Or that idea is a theoretical error, and they label that underconsumption, and they claim that only the falling rate of profit, it's this emphasis on the falling rate of profit as limiting capital investment, is what triggers crisis. That's the main lever. What are both sides of this missing when it comes to understanding the dynamics of debt and how it relates to crisis formation?
Well, you've actually said two things. I'll talk about the owing our debt to the selves first. It seems very simple. You can say we owe the debt to ourselves, so it all balances. But who's the we? The we are us guys, the 99%. Who are they ourselves? The ourselves are the bondholders, the 1%. We don't owe the money. We don't owe the money to each other. We owe the money to the banks and the 1%. The question is, who is the we and who is the ourselves? What the statement really means is that the 99% owe more and more debt to the 1%, and that is what leaves much less available for spending, as I just said. Can't imagine why you would think that the Marxists don't realize this. The Marxists, of all the groups, were the first to focus on finance capitalism. Rudolf Hilferding wrote Finance Capital around World War I. Lenin wrote Imperialism, all about finance. Hyman Minsky, who was the founding father along of MMT, was a Marxist. He told me that when he studied at the University of Chicago, our mutual friend, Maynard Krieger was his mentor, and most of us at UMKC and the early MMTers were all Marxist. Certainly the Marxist television and internet reviewers, people like Laura Flanders, are focused on finance. And in France, Eric Toissant from the Fourth International focuses on it. So the Marxists have taken the lead in analyzing finance, but not all Marxists. So here's the difference between who's the we and who are the they. Many people who call themselves Marxists only read Volume 1 of Capital, and that's where Marx talked about the distinguishing feature of finance capital, of industrial capitalism, being wage labor. Employers hire workers to produce goods and services, and they sell what labor produces at a markup, and that's surplus value. So the question is, how do workers ever afford to buy what they produce? Well, Marx explained that underconsumption can never cause a problem because as the capitalists are making more money by employing workers to make more goods, they build more factories, and they have to build more machinery. And because of technology, machinery is more and more efficient. So every new factory, every new machine they buy is more productive than the last generation. And that means that new producers come online, undersell their competitors, and so the old factories have to invest in new machinery too, and there is a very large increase in purchases of machinery. Now, the problem is that Marx wrote, discussed this in Volume 2 and Volume 3 of Capital, and my guess is that 90% of people who call themselves Marxists have never read Volumes 2 or 3. And I think I've known all the leading Marxists in the world in the last 60 or 70 years. I want to say something about what Marx did say. Marx really was the last classical economist, and his ideas followed from the ideas of Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill and Ricardo. And what all the economists before him were saying is there's a lot of exploitation in the economy, and if we're going to have an efficient economy, we can't have exploitation. The biggest exploiters were the landlords, because they collected rents, as John Stuart Mill said, in their sleep. They're hereditary. Because their ancestors conquered England, they get to collect all this rent. The whole fight of classical political economy was to either nationalize the land or tax away the rent, or at least get rid of the landlords. That's why they called John Stuart Mill a Ricardian socialist. There were many kinds of socialism. The other kind of predatory exploitation was, of course, banks and usury. And Marx naturally wrote Volume 1 about what he was writing about, finance capitalism, but then he wrote Volumes 2 and 3 to say, let's look at what the good side of industrial capitalism is going to be. We're already seeing it. Its fight for its historical destiny, and its destiny is to get rid of landlords, so people are not going to have to pay land rent anymore. It's going to be to get rid of private banking and usurious banking, and instead of making predatory loans to governments or to people, banks will become part of the industrial process. And when Marx wrote this, that was actually occurring in Germany, Austria, and Central Europe. So Marx, at the time he died in the 1870s, he thought that industrial capitalism was on the way to getting rid of feudalism, to getting rid of the legacy of feudalism, getting rid of the landlords, getting rid of the banks. As it happens, that hasn't worked out. We've had just the opposite. In Volume 3 of Capital, he goes into, he discusses finance, and he says, I've been talking in Volume 1 about industrial capitalism and production and consumption. Finance is external to the economy. Finance doesn't have anything to do with profits. A debt grows by compound interest. It's purely mathematical, he points out. The compound interest growth is much faster than an economy grows, so the finance is going to cause crashes, and Marx was about the first to come out with a theory of the business cycle based on finance being external to capitalism. And at the end of Volume 3, and he also wrote his theories of surplus value in three volumes about this, he thought that, industrial capitalism is going to act in its own self-interest, and it's going to get rid of places like Citibank and Wells Fargo, and is going to become much more productive. But that isn't how it worked out. Now, the question is, how do you get Marxist to read Volume 3. Last year, David Harvey and I went to the second global meeting of Marxism at Peking University in China. And David, as you know, teaches at CUNY Graduate School over here. He gave the final plenary speech that was pretty much just like his leading-in speech, saying, you guys have to read Volume 3 of Capital. China has a financial problem. You have to realize that the big problem threatening the Chinese economy is the same problem that's threatening the American economy, and that's debt growing so high that it's going to just leave the economy in austerity and depression. I gave a similar speech on that that has just been published by the Chinese Academy of Social Science. And I'd given one of the plenary speeches 3 years earlier at the first school. Well, I don't think we got a very good reception there. And one of my fellow professors at Peking University told me that I have to understand that the Chinese language, that Marxism is the Chinese word for politics in China. And David Harvey called China a neoliberal economy with Chinese characteristics. So I thought of calling it a neoliberal economy with Chinese internal contradictions. But at any rate, we're all focusing, all of us are Marxists. Our background is Marxist. We may not call ourselves Marxist, because that's not considered a nice word over here, as it is in China. But we all come out of that tradition. And it was very funny. Back in the 1960s, we used to joke that American capitalism was the only Marxist capitalism in the world, because the major economists on Wall Street all came out of the Marxist tradition. I was at Chase Manhattan. My friend Judd Higgins was at Lazare Frères. Andre Sharon was at Drexel Burnham. There were a bunch of others I won't name. But we all used to get together once a month to discuss what was happening on Wall Street. And I remember, I think I mentioned this before. One evening we were all discussing, well, wait a minute, what did Marx say in Volume 3? And then we laughed, you know, if they knew that here we were the Marxist economists, the economists for the big organizations, and we're all following Marx. So I find it bizarre that, unfortunate that many Marxists, that so many, have not read Marx. And I must say, I knew this was a fact as a little kid, because I, when I'd go over to the house of my father's friends, I'd go. They'd be talking, and I'd look at the bookcase, and the books that I recognized were the Charles Kerr edition of the three volumes of Capital, and I'd always open them, and I'd notice volumes 2 and 3 had never been opened. They were for show. And I think that that must be the economist that you've had. But Marx basically explained that industrial capitalism wouldn't have a crisis coming from industrial underconsumption, but it would have a crisis from the financial wrapping around the economy. And when I went to school 60 years ago, Marxists were the only people talking about this, and even today they're the only people talking about it, which is why my academic affiliation is in China and Kansas City and a few other places, not in the neoliberal mainstream.
So I wanted to ask one more question around debt in particular, that, you know, we're seeing the Washington Post recently reported that American corporate debt has surpassed $10 trillion, which is roughly the equivalent of 47% of the entire economy. Do you think that this could trigger the next crisis? And how would this debt bubble be different from the housing bubble? A little bit going back to this question around the real economy and the financial economy.
Well, $10 trillion may seem a lot, but it really is only twice the cost of the Afghan war when you get right down to it. Nonetheless, Wall Street is increasingly worried about the corporate junk bonds. With interest rates down to about 1%, there have been a lot of speculators and corporate raiders that borrow very inexpensively to buy companies and take them over. And so you have an enormous amount of corporate debt that's being added by people borrowing from banks to buy companies. And also companies themselves have been borrowing at maybe 1% to buy their stock that's yielding 8 or 9%. After President Trump's tax cuts, for instance, almost all of the money from the tax cuts were spent on tax buybacks. They weren't spent the way that Marx described industrial capitalists as spending their money on building new factories and hiring more labor. People are not making money by hiring labor anymore. They're making money by buying stocks and bonds and having the government artificially support their prices until finally they say it's all over, sell out, there will be a huge crash, the pension funds will all crash, and they're going to leave, they call the weak holders, the pension funds and the non 10% holding the bag, as it were. So if the economy is shrinking, then obviously the flow of profits, the output is going to be shrinking, unless companies can simply sell less goods, but for much more. And so the Trump administration has followed the Democrats in getting rid of the anti-monopoly legislation and prosecution. They're essentially promoting just rising prices for everything. So the question is, how long can companies get by producing less, charging more, when the customers are poor and poor? And you're not selling to China anymore, or Russia, or even Europe, because they can't trust American suppliers, or they don't want to buy more Boeings. Trump has wanted them to buy at least a military industrial goods, but they're pushing back on that. So obviously there are a lot of corporations that are going to go the way of Toys R Us, Sears, Roebuck. You see, the retail stores are the first that are going bankrupt. Then you're going to have the heavily leveraged buildings where either the building goes bankrupt or you borrow from the Saudi Arabians, like Trump's family have done. So the housing bubble was very largely fraud, to answer your question, but the corporate bubble is just plain greed, and finance lives in the short term. They all know that the debts can't be paid. Everybody I talk to on Wall Street knows that there's going to be a crash, but they think they can sell out first because someone from the government or the Fed will call them and say, we're going to raise interest rates suddenly, bail out, and they're all going to bail out and leave the non-insiders holding the bag, or at least they think that they can do that. But this isn't talked about in the press because bad economic news doesn't attract advertisers to the newspapers. And newspapers, their clients are the advertisers, not really the readers. So the newspapers are going to say, yes, the economy's growing, everything's doing fine. And politically, the media worry that if they say, well, we're in an economy that's shrinking and living standards are going to fall, then Wall Street's siphoning off the money, then people are going to turn socialist. Well, obviously, you're not going to have the government economists creating a body of socialists by telling them how the economy really works and what's in store for them all. So that's the problem, cognitive dissonance.
So I remember in 2009, I was a graduate student at Columbia University and asking one of my professors, one of my economics professors, you know, he was explaining how consumption in this economy, consumption had to be brought back up to its levels to keep growing the economy. It just seemed like we were recreating some of the same patterns that had led to this problem in the first place. And so, I mean, it seems to me also that there's a need, not just an opportunity, a need for new economic thinking, new political economy for today. Do you see any signs of that? Just in terms of a new political economic theory to actually take in the conditions for today and not just explain them, but help to anticipate what should be, you know, what we should be looking out for and the direction we should be
Well, advertisers always say that you use the word new, whatever you're doing, and that usually sounds good. But in this case, it doesn't. There's a perfectly good economic analysis. It's the 19th century analysis. Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, Ricardo, Marx is the last classical economist, and he really tied it all together. After him, Thorstein Veblen, Simon Patton, there are a number of other people. So you already have what's been stripped away from economics is the concept of unearned income in the form of economic rent. In all of 19th century, Smith, Mill, Ricardo, Marx, Alfred Marshall, they were all talking about economic rent as unearned income, and that's what an economy should avoid. And yet today, the economy is all about unearned income. So what you need to do is reverse the dumbing down of economics that neoliberal economics is. You need to restore the concept of unearned income and exploitation. We used to joke, why is it that Marxists were the people who the leading banks and investment banks all hired? Well, it's because we knew the economy was all about exploitation. If you go to business school, you think it's all fair. You don't get it. That's not the kind of person you want really to be for a bank. Now, I must say, most of what I wrote was only for internal bank usage. David Rocker explained to me, Rockefeller explained to me that if they wouldn't publish my stuff unless it happened to meet their public relation desires, but not to write what I think the bank wanted me to write, but to write really what I found. And that's what we're all doing. And we knew it was all about exploitation, but none of us were teaching at universities. I did teach at the New School for Social Research, but its Marxists were so anti-Marxist, so vulgar, so dumb as economists, that I just got out of there and went happily back to Wall Street, where we could really talk about Marxism.
So I want to raise another new that's coming back around, as if, you know, with some new ideas, is a lot of references to the New Deal of the 1930s. And, you know, I wanted to ask, is that, you know, they were also facing a time of great economic disruptions, compelling new political formations and relationships between the state, between finance, between labor. Is how much of that era, given that it was also a heavily industrialized era, how much of that era should we still turn to, and what lessons can we draw from that, and how much should we kind of caution ourselves in looking back at that time?
That was not really an ideal. I was around in that era. My father was sent to jail for organizing the Teamsters Union as a Trotskyist in Minnesota. Minneapolis was the head of the Teamsters revolt with the general strike in the 30s. And Roosevelt said, look, the Democratic Party is based in the cities. We need the mafia. We need to put the mafia in charge of the labor unions, and we need to put the Communist Party in charge, because they promised not to go to strike in World War II if we get rid of the Trotskyists. So everybody I knew was drafted in, instead of being drafted into the army, they were drafted into jail for fighting against the Stalinism and against the mafia and the labor union movement, and basically against the crooks in the Democratic Party. Tobin was the head of labor, who was basically put in the mafia into the Teamsters, and the attorney general later wrote an autobiography where he admitted it was all a frame-up and that it was done. So I don't really, am not that great an admirer of Roosevelt. He did save capitalism, but he saved it for the capitalists. I think what we want to do is save capitalism for the socialists. I mean, the whole idea is to have capitalism save itself by evolving into socialism, not falling back into feudalism. And so the problem's really political. In the textbooks, you read Nutters like Friedrich Hayek raving about a centralized economy. We have a centralized economy. We have centralized planning. It's not done in Wall Street. It's centralized in Washington. It's centralized in Wall Street. So the question is, how do you get the centralized planning out of Wall Street and get it into the hands of the general government? This is what China has been able to do very successfully by keeping the banks in the control of the government so far. So they've avoided this. The key is to realize the need to isolate the financial sector and financial wealth, and above all, to get rid there can't be any recovery without writing down the debts. And the good thing about writing down the debts is you wipe out savings at the same time. You really want to wipe out the enormous quadrupling of savings of the 10% that's occurred since 2008. If you leave these savings in place, then they're going to essentially buy control of governments, buy control of the media, as you've seen, the Washington Post, by control of the TV media and the general media. So you've got to essentially pick up the fight that the 19th century was trying to do, of getting rid of the absentee landlords, getting rid of the banks, and getting rid of the parasites.
That That leads me to ask you for your advice, actually, Dr. Hudson. As you know, the Cairo Center is one of the conveners of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. This is a national campaign that's grounded in organizing in more than 40 states across the country. And as you made reference to, our numbers are, in fact, growing, not only because, you know, this is a timely campaign, but because of the conditions that you've been laying out and the growing poverty and dispossession and economic precarity that people are living in and the lack of responses from any, you know, and accountability from any, you know, governmental or any other form of authority. And you know, we're connected to these communities all over the country, and we're fighting around an agenda that is based on systemic racism, ending poverty, ending militarism and the war economy, and ending climate disasters emerging out of the relationship of all of these. I see that you're indicating that we should really take up some questions around debt. And I wonder if you actually have, you know, some advice for us in terms of what should we look out for? What should we prepare for? What should we, you know, think about organizing around in this period?
Well, your big problem is that people don't vote in their own self-interest. How do you get people to vote in their self-interest? And your other problem is that you're the target of a takeover by the Democratic Party would like to take you over, and the politicians. I worked with David Graeber with Occupy Wall Street for a long time, and he spent a lot of his time trying to fight off Move On and the other Democratic, the George Soros groups that were trying to take over their movement. The problem is, how do you avoid, with your constituency, how do you avoid identity politics? I watch the news, and there's only, the Democrats are talking about every kind of hyphenated American there is, from sexual hyphenations to ethnic hyphenations. There's only one kind of identity that they don't talk about. That's wage earners and consumers. That's the identity that you have in common, of debtors, of people who you're all being exploited by. You're part of an exploitive system, of a financial system, a real estate system, of tax system. And the problem is that both parties have the same donors, and they've decided, I guess about a few months ago, we know who the candidate's going to be and when the next election. Both parties have chosen the same candidate, Donald Trump. The Democrats' problem is, how do we get a candidate so bad that he's guaranteed to lose to Donald Trump, so that who's doing all of our wonderful policies? He's cutting the taxes on us. He's doing everything, and we get to blame them and say it's not us, it's the Republicans. I mean, who can they get that's really bad? Amy Klobuchar or Buttigieg? You know, they're just we've got to see what's going to happen when nobody gets 50% on the first ballot, and they don't let Bernie get it. Who are they going to bring? The internet is full of Hillary thinking that she can run again, and who can they get that's as close to Hillary as possible? I guess that's Mayor Bloomberg, sort of the dark horse. So that's what you're faced with. In America, if this were a European-style parliamentary system, you could start your own party, and immediately you'd have something called, let's call it, the Social Democrat Party. And the Democrat Party here would fall to the same proportion that the Social Democrats in Germany have, 8%. Immediately, the Democratic Party would shrink into absolutely nothing. But the way that American politics are set up, you have to be one party or another. That's why AOC has to run as a Democrat, because that's how they set up. It's an either-or thing. And how do you take over a Democratic Party when the lawsuit in 2016 by the supporters of Bernie was, wait a minute, the Democratic Party doesn't have to nominate who the voters vote for. That's merely a cosmetic vote. The Democratic Party are the 10 or 12 people who run the party, the officials, and they get to decide who the president is. So these 10 officials who are, again, part of the Clinton-Rubin group, are going to decide the president, not the voters at all. So it's really the political system is so tied in a knot that I don't see anything happening. Right now, I'm writing a sequel to Forgiven Their Debts, which is about debt in classical antiquity, the collapse of antiquity, and we're in a situation very much like Rome was in from about 63 BC to 44 BC when Caesar was assassinated. You had the Senate was, Roman Senate was as bad as the American Congress and Senate, absolutely refusing to do any debt relief, refusing for any housing relief, any land relief. They were absolutely resisted progress, and the voting system was sort of like the ideal of the Citizens United case. The votes of the rich people, the few people who were the richest 10%, were given a voting power that was larger than all the other four classes below them. And so there was no way, Rome was never a democracy, and there was no way that the citizenry at large could get representation to write laws in its own favor. And so the only way out was armed force. And Catiline put together an army and tried to fight, and Caesar was supporting him a lot, but he was killed in 63, and then all of his supporters were illegally murdered in jail by Cicero, who later Caesar made sure was exiled. And then Caesar bided his time. He learned from Catiline's mistakes. Finally, he came in, brought his army into Rome in 49, and tried to be a sort of middle, a mediator in the middle. But he, by trying to get both sides, being a middle of the roader, if an economy is polarizing, there's no such thing as a middle. If you if you're in the middle, a centrist, then you're standing aside while the economy continues to polarize. And so the Senate simply killed him. And Cicero, who was the lobbyist for the creditors, called fenerators. That's usury takers. What a wonderful word, fenerator. And he said he wished he was there to share in the pleasure of plunging the knives into him. And so that brought in, finally, there was no more chance of political change at all. And you had the empire. And I don't see how America is very much different from that. I don't see any way in. I know that Bernie Sanders and his supporters hope that somehow they can do something in the Democratic Party, and I'm waiting to see what will happen next spring or summer when he comes in with most of the votes and they end up nominating Hillary again. So I don't know what you can all do.
Well, we will continue to seek your advice because you remain one of the most incisive and insightful economists, kind of, you know, showing us what's coming and drawing lessons from antiquity and you know, broad swaths of history to bring to today. And that's really been it's been something that's really informed the work of the Cairo Center and the campaign. And we look forward to more conversations with you as things kind of evolve, and we'll see where we go. But we do have some time now for questions from the audience. We have a great group gathered here tonight, and so I don't know. Do we? Okay, so let's see. If I can get some hands, then I will. Or Leanne, are you here? Okay. We don't have another mic. Okay, great. So maybe we can ask three questions. Hear three questions, then you'll have a chance to respond, and then I hope we'll have time to hear maybe three more. Does that work?
Sure, plenty of time.
Okay, so could we get three questions? Okay, so I saw you right here with the Bernie hat, over here with the white something, and then right here.
With the
shirt, so
1, 2, 3. So how do you compare Bernie and Elizabeth Warren? How do you compare between
the two of them?
Between Bernie Sanders,
yeah,
and Elizabeth Warren.
Warren. Bernie and Warren. So looking at both of those. So let's hold back, and so we'll wait on those just so we can make the most use of our time. Yep. Mm-hmm.
About the public banking demand, what do you think about that? It's something that's been brought up in cities and states around the country. Ellen Brown wrote that
public
book
banking
about public banking. Do you think that that is sort of a useful demand? Is that a viable kind of evolutionary move to sort of take over?
Got it.
Finance to make it a public utility?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that's could grow, could move?
Great. Thank you. This was in public banking. And then, yep.
Yeah, there's an article on Zero Hedge from back in April, and it talks about how more people are out of work now than were at the height of the recession in 2008. And they talk about the honest unemployment rate, which they basically is combining the U3 with the workforce participation rate findings, and how can we push that further? Because I talk about that all the time online. People act like I have three heads.
So about that.
Okay, three questions. Regarding Bernie versus Warren, I'm certainly in favor of Bernie. Warren would make a great Secretary of the Treasury. That really is where her imaginative and technical expertise lies, in regulating the financial sector. You need somebody who knows how financial crime works and what to do. But I don't think she has anywhere the breadth of policy beyond that that Bernie has. And he certainly has very good people around him, including my colleague Stephanie Kelton as one of his monetary and financial advisors. So Bernie for president, Warren for the cabinet. Regarding public banking and Ellen Brown, she just put me on the board of directors of her group. I'm all in favor of public banking. Just imagine what would have happened if Sheila Bair would have had her way in 2008 and she could have fought against Obama and Geithner and the crooks around Obama and closed down Citigroup, like she wrote in her autobiography. Imagine if you had Citibank acting in the public interest instead of its own interest. It would actually, imagine a bank that would actually lend money to factories to employ people and produce instead of take over loans to factories that outsource the labor and downsize and do everything. So, of course, public banking would make a different kind of loan than commercial banking would do, which is why in the 19th century, almost everybody expected banking to emerge into at least a quasi-public banking, as you had in the German Reichsbank and the Central European banks. So Ellen focuses on public banking because she doesn't think there's much chance of really having a debt write-down. Practically, at least not in her lifetime, and she's probably right about that. But I certainly think it's a good idea. It's a good idea. Both of us are closely associated with Democracy Collaborative in Washington, Gar Halperovitz's organization. So we're both working on that. Regarding unemployment statistics, you're right. The unemployment does not count people not in the labor force who've given up. But the even worse feature about unemployment is people who are taking jobs, low-wage jobs. For instance, I had to take an Uber car from a TV interview the other day, and the Uber driver was a PhD from another country, driving the car, and he said, he'd turned 53 years old. He'd worked for an insurance company as an economist, but he was fired because they said, we're firing everybody over 53 because we want to keep our health care cost down, and if we keep you here, it's going to raise the cost of your salary. You won't get any of the money, but we have to pay the health insurers more money. So he spent 7 months looking for a job, he said, and finally ended up driving an Uber car. So part of the problem is low-wage labor. The deunionization is another problem. But also there's a race to the bottom in labor. I know a lot of people, for instance, suppose you're, who are the There must be a lot of economist PhDs who are driving Uber cabs these days, because I'm not sure what else they can do. What do you do if you're a PhD and you just graduated? Universities are trying to hire you as a part-timer. Mm-hmm. You'll for $2,000 or $3,000 a year, you'll teach just one course. You don't get medical care. You don't get any pension or anything. They're all outsourcing and downsizing, and so the higher the education you get, really, the lower the salary seems to be. And you know, if you were a plumber, you would have been able to make a better living. So there's a lot of underemployment or people at low-wage labor. And in the companies that are financialized and taken over by raiders, they find that there's going to be an attrition of the labor force as people leave. And if they don't replace them, then they're just going to tell the existing workforce, work even harder. And that's called raising productivity, because you have this, the people have to work harder, produce the same output, but there are fewer and fewer laborers producing this output. They're squeezed, and the idea is it's okay to burn them out. Burn them out as much as you can by the age of, say, 50 or 53, because then you want to fire them anyway because of the medical care costs. That's why they're fighting Bernie so much. They want to use the medical care as a way of keeping labor in quiet, because if you're dependent on your job for your medical insurance or that of your spouse, you're not going to complain about your job. You're not going to go on strike and lose a paycheck and all of a sudden having your credit card rates go up. So again, they're using debt, medical care, and the rising cost of living that you're having, the squeeze you're all having, that's their solution to the problem. That's what's making them rich. Mm-hmm. So think for a while, not so much about poverty, think about who's getting... How are all these people getting richer and richer and richer? How is all this wealth being created at the top of the pyramid? Where is it coming from? That's what economists hate to say. And, you know, Adam Smith called his book The Wealth of Nations. He didn't mean financial wealth, but obviously we're now in financial capitalism, not industrial capitalism. So you're right. The statistics are not very helpful. We're in finance capitalism, something completely different, which is the step just before neo-feudalism. So it's going back.
Yeah, I just wanted to add also, just in terms of the employment numbers, that the incarcerated population isn't included in those either. And as we know that there's been a growth, you know, so what do you do with people who there are no jobs for and can't afford housing or basic needs? The incarceration population grows as well. It's another way to kind of hide the crisis behind paltry measurements and definitions.
Yeah, John Williams has shadow statistics, as I'm sure you know, that do a better job.
So could we get another round of questions right here, and then you up front, and then in the back by the pillar? 1, 2, 3.
Okay, you were talking about save socialism. That is one of the things that you were talking about. So I just wanted to go back and tell you that I was in Chile in August, and I noticed one thing. And one big thing was that I noticed a lot of old people selling whatever they could get a hand on the street and all over the place. So now when you're talking about socialism, I'm talking about now Social Security, and you mentioned about the Democrats trying to take it away. So what do you think is going to happen here? Because I saw that situation in Chile, and if it did, they cut down the way that they did it in Chile, they cut down the pensions and all those things. What would happen in this country? And this is something, every time that you're talking about Latvia and Greece, and I went to, and I also went to Argentina, and I'm going to tell you, an Uber cost me a little bit more than $2 with the exchange. It was just...
Yep.
So the question of Social Security, up front.
Oh, thanks for bringing that Adam Smith revelation to me about Adam Smith being connected to the Marxist way of thinking as well, and letting business do as they wish, as he said. Thanks also for recognizing that we peons... use another term, the poor people's campaign is one thing, but it's someone below the poor people's campaign you mentioned. Did you say the peasants or the some term you used over
there. Feudalism, serfdom, neo-serfdom.
When you had your conversation, you mentioned something is lower than the poor people. Anyway, what, the vultures eat up...
The Germans used to call it Lumpenproletariat.
Okay, so right. So that includes... We don't have to worry about the poor people. We're only talking about poor people anymore. We're talking about the whole lot of us.
Yeah.
And the last question I want to ask, when it comes to Michael Douglas, he did the Wall Street Never Sleeps thing, and he just came out on recently about how the political system has been hijacked. Did you hear that one?
What's been hijacked?
The political system.
Yes, yes.
Michael Douglas said the system has been hijacked. What do we do as people who have had our political system hijacked do to make these people who have hijacked it bow down to us?
Great.
Yeah, this actually kind of leads into the second question, but for your discussion of Marx and the distinction Marx makes between industrial capital and finance capital and how industrial capital evolved into socialism, another part of that is because industrial capital creates industrial proletariat, right? It creates a class that has a class consciousness that is able to be asserted politically. And one of the byproducts of precarity or of like us becoming like new peons is that it makes that consciousness more difficult because we're not sitting next to each other on assembly lines, you know, right? So what then, and this can come from your experience with the poor people's movement as well, but what then creates consciousness that then allows for political change in the context of the workings of finance capital and this new economy?
Great.
Okay, regarding what you said about Chile, I wish you're all familiar with Chile. That was the model for the George Bush administration and especially for the Obama administration. I think I've said this at a meeting here before. The genius of the Chicago boys who designed Chile was you can't have a free market unless you're willing to kill everybody who disagrees with you. You have to kill every labor leader, every land reformer, every protest. If you don't kill them, there's going to be a protest, and that is probably the leading premise of free enterprise economics. I can't figure out why they don't put this in the textbook, because that's the first thing they do in practice. They had a Chicago boy. One of the Chicago boys who designed it was Professor Harberger at Chicago, and he tried to get a job at Harvard as head of the Harvard Institute of International Development, and I'm proud of the students. I was associated with the Peabody Museum there. The students all rebelled by saying, this is the guy who sat in his hotel room fingering who was going to be assassinated to create the free market. Chile had a great tactic for wiping out really all of the pensions. George Bush said that he took the Chile's plan as a pension plan as the ideal for what America should have. He called it people's capitalism. And the idea was you give workers a share stock in the company they work for. Sounds good, and you have many fraudsters supporting that as sort of workers' capitalism. What the Chileans did was saying, okay, we have this factory, and we'll give the workers stock in it, but we're also going to have another corporation, and we have a whole group of corporations, and it'll be a financial corporation that lends money to the factory that the workers work for. And so they were called the grupos in Spanish. And so the corporations would lend money to the factory, and the workers would take much less. Part of their wages would be set aside. Instead of giving them money for wages, you'd give them stock in the company, and then all of a sudden the creditor would foreclose, the corporation would go bankrupt, wiping out all the stockholders. This immediately became the model for how U.S. Companies should work. You had the Chicago Tribune bought out by Sam Zell, a real estate guy who had the Tribune people put all of the workers, reporters and typesetters, put their salary into the Tribune stock. He had organized a financial shell, foreclosed, wiped out all the workers. So you want to really beware of people's capitalism, that if it's wrapped in a financial shell, which is what the Spanish did. And you have Pinero, who designed the plan, who I think is still there, and there has to be a revolution against them, and that's what you're having in Chile right now. There really is no solution except revolution. I guess truth in advertising. I must say my father was committed to jail for advocating the overthrow of the government by force and violence, the Smith Act, but it was a frame-up. But I just had to acknowledge a little bit of prejudice there when it comes to how to solve things. So, yes, that... the intention of the people run the American government, both parties, are to wipe out the pension funds in a way much like happened in Chile, or and to cut back Social Security. Regarding the what is the second system of the political system? What to do? I don't think there is a solution under the American political system. There's a difference between a problem and a quandary. A problem can be solved. If we were in Europe, you'd start your own party, you'd get all the votes, and you'd throw out the other people. But you're in a quandary. There's no way out. You can't start your own party because the Democrat Party are the 12 richest people, you know, the Wall Street thugs who run the whole party, and they don't care what the voters vote for. It's all a charade. They've already picked. They want Donald Trump for the second term is the ideal Democrat. So, or the ideal, kleptocrat or whatever you call the stage of finance capitalism that we're in today. So you talk about, the answer is class consciousness. Well, class consciousness was easy 100 years ago. The class you're in, you were wage earners. And the problem were the people who employed you and were trying to pay you as little as possible and calling in the thugs to beat you up if you went on strike and calling in the FBI to deport you or to frame you up or to shoot you or you have Malcolm X or Martin Luther King. So the problem is I don't see any way out except violence. I'm not advocating that. Don't want to, but I don't see any other way out. Otherwise, you're going to starve quietly in the dark.
If what Nick Bronner movement for People's Party, third party
movement for People's Party,
Bernie. Are you familiar with that movement?
Bernie thought a lot about what to go, and he realizes that in the state, each state in America has its own voting laws, and in order to get on the ballot in the presidential election, you have to have tens of thousands of voters, many more than the Republican and Democrat, and if you have one bad signature, the entire page is all thrown out, and so you can be sure that the dirty tricksters come in and put in false signatures, false addresses, or somebody misspells, can't read the number. So it's almost impossible for a third party to succeed in America the way that they've set up the game. So the only way to do is to make sure that the Democratic Party loses almost it completely emptied out, so Wall Street will walk away, and then you take it over. That'll be 50 years, and most of you will be dead, and the population will be about half what it is now. So, but that's...
I wanted to also offer because the opening was made, you know, to how the Poor People's Campaign is also thinking about this question of consciousness. And, you know, some of the Cairo Center had been thinking about the Poor People's Campaign for at least a decade, you know, for many years, kind of comes out of a history that's connected to the 1968 campaign, and had been thinking about and organizing with poor communities in the form of homeless organizing, welfare rights organizing for many years before this new this revival of the campaign in 2018. And, you know, we've remained so far nonviolent and also nonpartisan. We recognize that the political system is both compromised and doesn't offer the solutions that we actually need. And so one of the goals, in fact, you know, as we were thinking about it, was how do you create a new pole, right, that breaks through this dichotomy of left and right, and get people to talk about, as Reverend Barber says, not left and right, but right and wrong. And this question of morality tends to then activate, you know, bring people. So it's not consciousness in the form necessarily of class consciousness, but the thing is, people are waking up every day to new crises and multiple crises, right? So there's organizing happening around low wages in the form of the Fight for 15 and Raise Up and these other kind of low wage worker organizations. There's organizing happening around homelessness. The National Union of the Homeless launched in multiple cities a few months ago, and so that, you know, you have homeless encampments that are now organized themselves into unions, and they are you know, building power. You have water struggles breaking out everywhere around water shutoffs, and so these are also kind of compelling communities to find each other, right? And so it's not a form of class consciousness, because the other side a little bit more diffused, but, you know, as good Marxists and, you know, the appreciation of dialectics, the strength is also weakness, because they're everywhere. The base that can rise up against it is also everywhere. And as they're finding each other in these crises that are breaking out every day, that consciousness is arising. The question is how to organize it, right? And so that's the question the campaign is facing, and other forms. I think, right. Yes.
Vocabulary is very important in consciousness, because that the question is, if you can get a different vocabulary, that's what my book, J is for Junk Economics, is all about. It's vocabulary. I think we should introduce the word kleptocrats. Don't call them industrial capitalists or finance capitalists. Call them kleptocrats, because that's what they are. And whether they're politicians as part of the kleptocracy or the actual Wall Street financiers, I think you make it clear that they're not industrial capitalists. And what we have in America is not capitalism as anyone in the 19th century expected it to be. You can talk about neo-feudalism. You can talk about debt peonage, neo-serfdom. If you use, don't accept their vocabulary, because they have public relations focus groups organize the vocabulary to confuse you into using euphemisms. And almost all of the economic vocabulary is euphemisms. And just call it what it is. They want to make you essentially into serfs who have to do drive Uber or the gig economy or anything you can do. What?
Neo-fascism?
I'm not sure how neo it is. But fascism is sort of an old word. And they'll say, well, we're fascism with a friendly face. Just kleptocracy.
So we're actually at the end of our time. Did you want to offer any kind of final closing?
No, we began a little late. But
okay, should we take one
more?
Yeah,
one more round.
Okay, we'll take one more round of questions. All right, so we have someone over here, the person in the back by the screen, and then right here. Yep, sorry.
So could you talk a bit more about the America-China relationship? Because Trump put tariffs on China, and that was received with almost bipartisan support. There's a lot of Democrats that sort of think about the rivalry between China and the U.S. So how do you see, ideally, the economic and political relationship between China and the U.S. going forward?
Great. And then in the back by the screen, yep.
Yes, I would be curious as to speakers' thoughts on the similarities between...
Maybe he could step forward. Or you'll tell me what he's saying.
You spoke of fascism. see the ruling elites out of desperation going in that direction, and would there, what was Speaker Suda in their view looking at? I think that was the future.
He was asking about what fascism would look like. What would fascism look like?
Okay.
And then over here. Yes. Uh-huh.
So following up on what you mentioned in your answer to the public banking question about public banks would issue a new type of loan or a different type of loan, one of the things that I'm seeing and I'm interested in is all the different groups of folks who are interested in starting enterprises now that are organized differently, financed differently, with different structures, as sort of just going forward and creating a new economy with new structures. And so I would like to know if you have any wisdom on how to form a, for lack of a better word, investment policy statement, or you know, how would people organize financing of new enterprises that is not, you know, the debt that compounds and snowballs and gets
people into
trouble.
Can I answer a question, the same topic? Can I just add on to
my question?
Sure.
How many people come together and instead of taking all of your money and throwing it to the insurance industry, the health insurance industry, why can't we create an overall people's insurance company?
People's insurance.
What?
A people's insurance company.
Yeah. That fund and put these people out of business.
Okay. So we have the three questions.
What was his question? Did he ask in the back?
He asked in the back on fascism.
Yeah.
And kind of
but just before her, there was a question.
Yes, this question
was the girl? What did she say?
She was asking about what a kind of investment strategy or policy would look like.
Under what?
Under a public banking system, basically. That would be different than what we currently
have.
Okay.
Okay, I guess these will be the last three questions then. Regarding China, I've just published something. It should be on my website for the Academy of Social Science in China on de-dollarization. There are. It's obvious that the United States is trying to split from China. There's a fight over who can monopolize high technology, especially information technology. And China has done something that Americans really hate. They don't have American spyware on their phones. And this infuriates the Americans. They're insisting that Europeans only buy phones and computers with American spyware built into it. Otherwise, we don't know what Angela Merkel is saying. So this has led China, Russia, and other countries to realize that the United States, now that the United States is not a free trader anymore, now that it is not the world's most efficient technology producer, all it can do is protest and be a protectionist. And so they are moving as fast as they can to integrate themselves. China, Russia, Europe, certainly Germany, other countries are now joining in the other world. And I must say that I'm not a very efficient, obviously, or I wouldn't be right here right now. I'm not an efficient revolutionist. Donald Trump is a genius who's accomplished much more than I could ever do. He's uniting the whole world to break away from the American financial system, to de-dollarize. He's driving China, Europe, Russia together. I think he deserves the Peace Prize for that, because nobody else has been able to do that. So they're going their own way. Regarding fascism, Trotsky gave a good example in the 1930. He said, fascism is the failure of the socialist parties to provide an alternative. And that was at a time when Stalin told the Communist Party to support Hitler and not to fight Hitler. And, of course, you had 1 million Germans under arms at the time Hitler took power. they quit the Communist Party in disgust, and Hitler took over. Earlier, Stalin had told the Chinese Communist Party to support Chiang Kai-shek, who ended up assassinating the entire leadership, millions of Chinese communists, the Shanghai Massacre in the late 1920s. Again, if socialists cannot provide an alternative, then you're going to have fascism, which is really the ideal University of Chicago free enterprise economy. Freedom to just grab everything that you can in any way that you can. The free market is basically a market. It decriminalizes every kind of financial appropriation. So it's fascism is what it's basically what happens when you dismantle government and you privatize. Fascism is privatization, basically, especially privatization of the financial sector, basic utilities, and it's a breaking up of labor unions, and it's a hostility towards other countries that do not join your system. Regarding what people a public banking would do, or public insurance company, public banking wouldn't make loans for corporate takeovers. It wouldn't make loans to like community banks will make loans to borrowers who will buy a rental building, kick out all the tenants and turn it into condominiums and make a profit. They wouldn't make loans for antisocial purposes or for corporate rating or for corporate buybacks or for essentially finance capitalism purposes. They'd make loans to people who could with the idea that you make loans to people who can pay, not who can't pay, and you get to foreclose on their property. Regarding people's health insurance, that's an awful idea. Health insurance should be public. It's the job of this is a human right. In Germany and all in Europe and every civilized country, public health is public. You shouldn't have to pay because you can't afford to. If you had to pay for the health insurance, you'd be even poorer, and quite frankly, you can't afford it. The government should afford it, and it should afford it, and it should be a public guarantee, just like education should be public in character.
Let's thank Dr. Hudson again for being here tonight. And thanks to all of you for joining us in this conversation. Please check out his website, michael-hudson.com, and the Cairo Center and the People's Forum. Keep coming here. We have some great events in December. Thanks, everybody.